Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, October 31st, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article with the headline, State-Issued Report Card. MS lands four schools among exemplary 11. SJO, Cisna Park, two PVO schools among the others. Story by Jeff D'Alessio. Out of Mahomet. For the third time in as many years, Mahomet Seymour High School brought home a state report card worth tacking on the fridge, receiving the top designation handed out by the state. Only this time, the Bulldogs weren't alone. Its four-school district pulled off an area first Thursday when all four, including first-time exemplary designees Lincoln Trail Elementary, Middletown Prairie Elementary, and Mahomet Seymour Junior High, received the highest marks available from the Illinois State Board of Education. In all, 11 of 142 area schools were deemed exemplary after all of the 2024-25 data was crunched. The feeling was a familiar one for most of the others. In the 7 years that ISBE has summarized schools' performance in a single word, Flatville's Prairie View Ogden Junior High and Monticello High School have now received exemplary designations and area best 6 times. St. Joseph Ogden High School is exemplary for the 5th time, while St. Joseph Middle School made it 3 in a row and 4 times overall. 2 of the PVO District's 3 schools were given the highest mark, including Royals Prairie View Ogden North Elementary, a first-time exemplary finisher. Cisna Park also went 2 for 3, with the junior high three-peating and the high school winning number 3 and first since 2020. A wide mix of metrics go into the formula for determining schools' designation, from graduation rates, chronic absenteeism, and ninth graders being on the right track to proficiency and growth in English language arts, math, and science. Kenny Lee, the fourth-year superintendent of a Mahomet Seymour district with the area's largest middle school and 2 largest elementaries, was quick to heap praise on the school board for supporting the creation of a strategic plan that has led to new literacy and math initiatives, and district staff for implementing it with fidelity. But that doesn't happen if students don't show up for school, and far more of them did on a daily basis than the year prior. All 4 Mahomet Seymour buildings scored far better than the state average of 25.4% for chronic absenteeism, which state law defines as students who miss 10% of school days within an academic year, with or without a valid excuse. That amounts to 17.5 days in an average 175-day school year. Every school in the district saw sizable drops from 2023-24 to 2024-25. Lincoln Trail from 13.5% to 7.7%, Middletown Prairie from 10.8% to 5.8%, the junior high from 27.6% to 13.2%, the high school from 29.8% to 18.4%. Our buildings have attacked chronic absenteeism with a laser-like focus, which is evidenced by our increase in attendance numbers across the board, Lee said. If you enter any building in our district, it is clear that attendance is a focus. Obviously, if students are at school, they have a better chance to learn the material being facilitated by our fantastic staff. Bring your best. The reward for another exemplary report card at Monticello High School? Ice cream for everyone, Principal Travis Corson vowed Thursday. The area's annual graduation rate leader posted another nifty number on its latest report card, 99.2%, in addition to English, math, and science proficiency rates that dwarf the state averages. We have great kids here, Corson said. Our students show up and strive to do and be their best every day. We talk to them about how your best may look different from one day to the next, which is okay. All we ask is that you bring your best for that day, and they do. Corson said teachers continue to try to raise the bar at Monticello, with the high school introducing instructional share days this fall. On these days, one department will meet for 3 hours in the morning, and another department will meet for 3 hours in the afternoon, he said. The time is spent looking at ACT data instructional practices, and curriculum mapping needs. At St. Joseph Ogden, which received its fifth exemplary report card in 6 years, Principal Gary Page said, "Our community's expectation is that we provide a high-quality learning environment where students have an opportunity to excel. By focusing on meeting this expectation, the individual components of the report card take care of themselves." CU grades, 72% of area schools received commendable designations, meaning no underperforming student groups, and for high schools, graduation rates better than 67%, in most cases much better. Heritage at 95.2%, Fisher 94.6%, Arcola 94.5%. Six Champaign schools earned commendable status: Barksdale Elementary, Carrie Busey Elementary, Centennial High School, Jefferson Middle School, Robeson Elementary, and Westview Elementary, one fewer than last year. Eight fell to the third tier: targeted, meaning more than one or more student groups at or below the lowest performing 5% statewide. And three got a comprehensive designation for one or more groups continuing to struggle after completing their focused improvement cycle. The area's other two largest districts had a mixed bag of results as well. Of Urbana's seven buildings that were open in 2024-25, only the high school and Yankee Ridge Multilingual School scored commendable finishes. The district also had two targeted and two comprehensive report cards, plus the area's lone intensive-rated school. Danville High School continued a three-year run of commendable designations and was joined by five elementaries: Edison, Mark Denman, Meade Park, Northeast, and Southwest. The district also had two comprehensive report cards and one targeted. The next story on the front page is 40 Under 40, They Mean Business. And it's a picture of a batch of people, young professionals. And up front is, with Women of the Year Shannon McFarland and Man of the Year Josh Rund leading the way, members of the 18th class of Central Illinois Business Magazine's 40 Under 40 gather at the iHotel and Illinois Conference Center after Thursday's celebration, attended by family, friends, and business leaders. And that's not a story, that's just a picture. Next front page story is Champaign's Springfield and Mattis neighborhood, former factory demolished to make way for apartments. Story by Jana Wiersema, out of Champaign. Work is underway at a property near the corner of Kenwood Road and Springfield Avenue that is set to become home to a new apartment complex. Community Property Management announced Wednesday that it has demolished the former C.S. Johnson factory and begun work to redevelop the approximately 9-acre site. CPM plans to build a mix of 228 one- and two-bedroom apartments. Company officials estimated that the first of these units will be finished by the end of 2026, with the entire project complete toward the end of 2027. "We are excited to be moving forward with the project and feel that this will help revitalize the Mattis Springfield area by providing housing for people wanting to live, work, and shop in this area," said CEO Nathan Shoemaker. Crews are currently working to dig a retention pond at the site and run utilities underground, company officials said. The future apartment complex will include amenities such as a heated pool and hot tub, dedicated pickleball courts, a walking trail, and outdoor fire pits and grills. Additionally, all tenants will receive a complimentary membership to the nearby Refinery Gym, which is co-located with CPM's Victoria Point Apartments at 2302 West John Street. Rent for the new apartments will range from $1,000 to $2,000, Shoemaker said. The development includes 8 apartment buildings, 1 storage building, and a clubhouse for residents. The project was designed by KAP Architecture, and Unity Construction will serve as the builder, CPM said. The company has secured a loan from Citizens Equity First Credit Union to help support the project. Additionally, Champaign City Council approved an incentive agreement for the development in July. According to a report from Associate Planner Daniel Safier, eligible demolition, utility, and environmental remediation costs will receive 100% reimbursement of the incremental property tax revenues generated by the project, up to $6.6 million, or for 10 years, whichever occurs first. The agreement also includes a 10% contingency of $660,000 in case of unforeseen cost overruns. Additionally, a one-year extension of the reimbursement period will be offered to the developer if the project is completed before December 31, 2027. The project is located within the city's Springfield and Mattis Tax Increment Financing District, which was created by the City Council in January, and also includes the Country Fair Shopping Center, Round Barn Shopping Center, Champaign Park Apartments, and Country Brook Apartments. The city created the 217-acre TIF district in the hope of revitalizing the area. A successful rezoning of the site from light industrial to multifamily medium density, together with the TIF, was a critical factor in launching the project, CPM officials said. Moving now to national and world news. Trump meeting with Xi. Deal reached with China. Soybean sales to resume, 12 million metric tons for rest of this year, 25 million each year for next three. Aboard Air Force One and the AP. President Donald Trump described his face-to-face with Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Thursday as a roaring success, saying he would cut tariffs on China, while Beijing had agreed to allow the export of rare earth elements and start buying American soybeans. The president told reporters aboard Air Force One that the U.S. would lower tariffs implemented earlier this year as punishment on China for its selling of chemicals used to make fentanyl from 20% to 10%. That brings the total combined tariff rate on China down from 57% to 47%. I guess on the scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the best, I would say the meeting was a 12, Trump said. I think it was a 12. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said China agreed to purchase 25 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans annually for the next 3 years, starting with 12 million metric tons from now to January. U.S. soybean exports to China, a huge market for them, had come to a standstill in the trade dispute. So you know, our great soybean farmers, who the Chinese used as political pawns, that's off the table, and they should prosper in the years to come, Bessent told Fox Business Network's Mornings with Maria. Trump said he would go to China in April, and Xi would come to the U.S. sometime after that. The president said they also discussed the export of more advanced computer chips to China, saying that NVIDIA would be in talks with Chinese officials. Trump said he could sign a trade deal with China pretty soon. Xi said Wednesday said Washington and Beijing would work to finalize their agreements to provide peace of mind to both countries and the rest of the world, according to a report on the meeting distributed by state media. Both sides should take the long-term perspective into account, focusing on the benefits of cooperation rather than falling into a vicious cycle of mutual retaliation, he said. Sources of tension remain. Despite Trump's optimism after a 100-minute meeting with Xi in South Korea, there continues to be the potential for major tensions between the world's two largest economies. Both nations are seeking dominant places in manufacturing, developing emergent technologies such as artificial intelligence, and shaping world affairs like Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump's aggressive use of tariffs since returning to the White House for a second term, combined with China's retaliatory limits on exports of rare earth elements, gave the meeting newfound urgency. There is a mutual recognition that neither side wants to risk blowing up the world economy in ways that could jeopardize their own country's fortunes. When the two were seated at the start of the meeting, Xi read prepared remarks that stressed a willingness to work together despite differences. Given our different national conditions, we do not always see eye to eye with each other, he said through a translator. It is normal for the two leading economies of the world to have frictions now and then. There was a slight difference in translation as China's Xinhua news agency reported Xi as telling Trump that having some differences is inevitable. Finding ways to lower temperature. The leaders met in Busan, South Korea, a port city about 47 miles south from Jeonju, the main venue for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. In the days leading up to the meeting, U.S. officials signaled that Trump did not intend to make good on a recent threat to impose an additional 100% import tax on Chinese goods, and China showed signs it was willing to relax its export controls on rare earths and also buy soybeans from America. Officials from both countries met earlier this week in Kuala Lumpur to lay the groundwork for their leaders. Afterward, China's top trade negotiator, Li Qiangyang, said they reached a preliminary consensus, a statement affirmed by U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who said there was a very successful framework. Shortly before the meeting on Thursday, Trump posted on Truth Social that the meeting would be the G2, a recognition of America and China's status as the world's biggest economies. The Group of Seven and Group of 20 are other forums of industrialized nations. But while those summits often happen at luxury spaces, this meeting took place in humbler surroundings. Trump and Xi met in a small gray building with a blue roof on a military base adjacent to Busan's international airport. The anticipated détente has given investors and businesses caught between the two nations a sense of relief. The U.S. stock market has climbed on the hopes of a trade framework coming out of the meeting. In more national and world news, U.S. government. In 51-47 vote, Senate snubs Trump on tariffs. Action is mostly symbolic because House is unlikely to act on the issue. Story by Alicia Diaz and Bloomberg News TNS. Out of Washington. The Republican-led Senate passed legislation opposing President Donald Trump's sweeping global tariffs, its third vote this week rebuking the White House's trade policies. The 51-47 vote, which included four Republicans, underscores growing economic anxiety over Trump's often changing tariff regime. Senators earlier this week narrowly passed bills to end emergency authorities underpinning the tariffs on Canada and Brazil. The resolutions are largely symbolic because the House still must pass them, and Republican leaders there have refused to take them up. But the votes are the clearest sign yet of growing Republican unrest over Trump's use of rarely used emergency powers to tariff imports. Republicans Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Kentucky's Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell voted with Democrats on the global tariff measure. The vote comes as Trump returns to Washington from a week-long trip to Asia, where he touted new trade agreement frameworks with various economic partners. He also agreed to an extended truce with China during his first face-to-face meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping since returning to the White House. The Supreme Court will hear arguments next week on the legality of the president's use of emergency power to impose the duties, after agreeing to hear the case on an expedited schedule. Trump lost similar legal challenges in lower courts. The Senate tried to pass the same legislation to end the global tariffs earlier this year, but it narrowly failed. Next story is Sean Grayson murder trial. Experts. Judges' instructions, cops' testimony likely influenced outcome. Out of Springfield in the AP. The killing of Sonia Massey in her home by an Illinois sheriff's deputy was pursued by prosecutors as a first-degree murder case with a possible life prison sentence. Then the judge gave the jury another option when deliberations began this week. Sean Grayson was found guilty Wednesday of second-degree murder, a lesser charge with less severe consequences. Massey's family was outraged by the verdict. The black woman's supporters called it the wrong dose of justice, noting she was deliberately shot in the face by a white police officer in her own kitchen. Experts say a verdict form with different options is common in Illinois courts and elsewhere, if the judge believes the evidence presented at trial could plausibly justify it. Grayson testified on his own behalf, claiming he felt threatened by Massey and her pot of hot water. "This is not unusual," Andrew Leipold, who teaches criminal law at University of Illinois College of Law, said of the jury's alternatives. Under Illinois law, second-degree murder recognizes the possibility that people honestly but unreasonably believe they're in danger, so they killed the person they're worried about, Leipold said. Grayson's story. No jurors talked to reporters about how they reached consensus on the conviction, but they were likely influenced by Grayson's version of what happened when he and another officer went to Massey's home in Springfield early on July 6, 2024. Massey had called 911 in the state's capital city, seeking help for a suspected prowler. Grayson, a Sangamon County Sheriff's deputy, arrived with another officer, and their encounter with Massey began to center on a boiling pot of water. Grayson said Massey, who had struggled with mental health, grabbed the pot after he had ordered the other officer to move it off the stove. "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus," she said, according to body camera video. Grayson testified that he feared being struck with the pot and the water. He had told investigators that he believed the rebuke meant Massey intended to kill him. He fired 3 shots, striking her just below the eye and killing her. "He believed that to be a threat," defense attorney Daniel Foltz said as he argued for an acquittal. "You don't have to believe that it was. That's what he believed." State's attorney John Millhiser said Grayson, who was eventually fired, didn't follow his training that night. "Send anyone else, anyone, and Sonia Massey is alive today," the prosecutor told the jury. Final jury instructions. Defense attorneys asked Judge Ryan Cadigan to add a second-degree murder option to the jury instructions after all the evidence was presented. Second-degree murder can apply in Illinois when a defendant faces a serious provocation or believes their action is justified, even if that belief is unreasonable. "It's the judge's call," said J. William Roberts, a former county prosecutor and U.S. attorney in Central Illinois. "If there are arguably facts that could support something less than first-degree murder, the court would almost always put it in rather than risk being reversed on appeal." The next story in national and world news is government shutdown. Judge questions plan to suspend SNAP benefits, but her expected ruling on issue failed to emerge by NG deadline. Out of Boston in the AP. A federal judge in Boston on Thursday seemed skeptical of the Trump administration's argument that SNAP benefits could be suspended for the first time in the food program's history because of the government shutdown. During a hearing over a request by 25 Democratic-led states to keep the funding flowing, U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani told lawyers that if the government can't afford to cover the cost, there's a process to follow rather than simply suspending all benefits. "The steps involve finding an equitable way of reducing benefits," said Talwani, who was nominated to the court by then-President Barack Obama. Talwani said she expected to issue a ruling later Thursday and seemed to be leaning toward requiring the government to put billions of dollars in emergency funds toward SNAP. "That," she said, "is her interpretation of what Congress intended when an agency's funding runs out." However, she had yet to issue a ruling as of 9 p.m. Central Time. "If you don't have money, you tighten your belt," she said in court. "You're not going to make everyone drop dead because it's a political game someplace." Talwani acknowledged that even ordering emergency funds to pay for SNAP might still be painful for some SNAP recipients, because it could mean they get less money and that the money they do get could be delayed. "We are dealing with a reality that absent 100% win for you, the benefits aren't going to be there in November 1st, she told the plaintiffs. The hearing came 2 days before the U.S. Department of Agriculture planned to freeze payments to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program because it said it can't continue funding it due to the shutdown. Other lawsuits have been filed over the program suspension, including one filed Thursday in Rhode Island by a coalition of 8 cities and community business and union organizations. SNAP, which costs about $8 billion per month, serves about 1 in 8 Americans and is a major piece of the nation's social safety net. Word in October that it would be a November 1 casualty of the shutdown sent states, food banks, and SNAP recipients scrambling to figure out how to secure food. Some states said they would spend their own funds to keep versions of the program going. Federal government shutdown. Illinois measures to offset SNAP cuts will not alleviate problem. Story by Maggie Doherty out of Chicago. Illinois mother of four and food delivery driver Aubrey Lewandowski says she immediately started rationing the food she had left after getting a text alerting her that her Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits may not come through next month. Lewandowski will be forced to choose between buying healthy food for her four children and paying rent and utility bills if the federal government does not allocate emergency funds by the Saturday deadline. She is one of roughly 1.9 million people in Illinois and 42 million across the country who depend on SNAP benefits each month. Illinois oversees the distribution of $350 million in federal SNAP benefits to qualifying low-income and disabled individuals and households each month. Illinois and other states sued the Trump administration earlier this week, arguing that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has the money to continue paying SNAP benefits using contingency funds appropriated by Congress for emergencies such as the government shutdown that began October 1st. U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani indicated in court Thursday morning that she would issue a ruling later in the day. She appeared to favor arguments requiring the government to allocate billions of dollars in emergency funds for SNAP. While awaiting Talwani's ruling, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an executive order allocating $20 million in state funding as a stopgap measure to support Illinois' seven food banks, which supply over 2,600 food pantries across the state. Half of the funding comes from the state's Budget Reserve for Immediate Disbursements and Governmental Emergencies Fund, or BRIDGE, and the rest comes from the Illinois Department of Human Services. Lawmakers put $100 million into the BRIDGE Fund last year to deal with emergencies caused by federal funding changes. Pritzker said in an unrelated news conference Thursday morning that the federal government had decided to shut down the SNAP machines, meaning the state could not deposit funds directly into SNAP accounts even if he wanted to. He called the decision insidious. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of our News Gazette, dated Friday, October 31st, 2025. Please stay tuned.